This is Ward Temple on KRCB-FM. I'm your host, Catherine Hastings. My first guest tonight is Paul Hoover, who is bringing with him just a little bit of William Shakespeare. Hoover is the author of several collections of poetry, including Edge and Fold and Poems in Spanish. He co-translated the selected poems of Friedrich Hölderlin with Maxine Chernoff, and with Nguyen Do, Beyond the Court Gate, selected poems of Nguyen Trai. He's also the editor of the Norton anthology, Post-American Modern Poetry, and with Maxine Chernoff, the literary magazine, New American Writing. He teaches at San Francisco State University. Hoover has made several treks to Sonoma County over the years to read at the live Word Temple poetry series, so many of you are familiar with him by now. Most recently, he appeared to present his latest book, Sonnet 56, and this is the book we'll be talking about tonight. Let's go now to Paul Hoover. Welcome, Paul.
Oh, it's good to be here.
It's nice to see another book out from you, and this one is Sonnet 56, and this book has 56 variations of William Shakespeare's Sonnet 56 that you wrote. When and how did this project begin for you?
The idea for doing a work relating to the exhaustive use of someone else's work, let's put it that way, that happened a long time ago because I had read Raymond Queneau's Exercises in Style, where he took a simple prose paragraph and did it several different ways. And it was funny because it was a very kind of puny quote that he used to begin with, you see.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, nothing extraordinary, not heroic writing, not even great writing, you know. But the whole idea was the exercise. And then one day I gave an assignment to my students to rewrite a Shakespeare sonnet. And that led ultimately to my doing 56 versions.
You're your own student.
I often do the same exercises that my students do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you gave them the assignment with Sonnet 56? Or was
Yes, and I chose Sonnet 56 because it has very modern-sounding end words or rhyming mm-hmm. words.
Did you know that you were going to write 56 versions?
No, I didn't. I had written many versions, and I decided to count them, and I was somewhere around 56. I was in the 50s, and I realized, oh, well, it'd be perfect to square it off then, right? So I wound up producing 56.
Okay. Well, you have some traditional forms in the book, like the villanelle, but many that are not traditional, like noun plus seven, larf. Why don't you read the original Shakespeare sonnet and then pick a handful of poems that you would like to read and explain what some of them are, like flarf or whichever ones you want to read.
Sure. Okay, well, here's the original Shakespeare sonnet, and each of these poems has a title, usually the form that it's in. This is called simply Shakespeare. Sweet love, renew thy force. Be it not said thy edge should blunter be than appetite, which but today by feeding is allayed, tomorrow sharpened in his former might. So love be thou, although today thou fill thy hungry eyes e'en till they wink with fullness. Tomorrow see again, and do not kill the spirit of love with a perpetual dullness. Let this sad interim like the ocean's be, which parts the shore, where two contracted new come daily to the banks, that when they see return of love, more blessed may be the view. As call it winter, which being full of care, makes summer's welcome thrice more wished, more rare. Now let me say, that's not a distinguished Shakespeare sonnet. It's not bad. It has some certain complexities, right? And it would be a little bit difficult to understand, and therefore is not a classic Shakespeare sonnet, like Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's mm-hmm. Day? So that's okay. Within it is a rhetoric of love found, love lost, and love regained, winter and summer. And that rhetoric really is very essential to the reuse of the sonnet. Let me give you an example of noun plus seven.
Okay.
Noun plus seven comes from the French group Oulipo. I'll explain that some other day, probably. But they come up with writing games.
Right.
Okay.
And for our listeners, that's Oulipo.
That's correct.
They can look that up. Yeah.
Yes. And they were founded in 1960, and Raymond Cano was one of the founders. And the idea is very simple. You take a dictionary, any dictionary, and you replace the original nouns, all the nouns of the poem, with the seventh after in any dictionary you have.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. Sweet love game, renew thy forecaster. Be it not said thy editor should blunter be than Applejack, which but today by feeling is allayed, tonality sharpened in his former mildew. So love game, be thou, although today thou fill thy hungry eye bright, e'en till they wink with foolery. Tomorrow see again, and do not kill the spirochete of love with a perpetual dumbbell. Let this sad interleaf like the ocotillo be, which parts the shortcake, where two contracted new come daily to the banker, that when they see revelation of love game, more blessed may be the vigilante. As call it winter melon, which, being full of carfare, makes sumpweeds well curb, thrice more wished, more rare.
So were forms like noun plus seven devised just as a form of entertainment? Were they looking to be humorous, or?
Yeah, what? I mean, inevitably you'll have to be humorous with that one.
Yeah.
Because the accidents,
to be their intent.
The accidents given you are inevitably funny. But I felt really blessed by the some of the words that came forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like ocotillo.
Right.
Eye bright. Sumpweeds well curb.
Yeah.
And I have another example that I often read right after that one, which is haikuization.
Mm-hmm.
You make a haiku of the Sonnet 56. And you could haikuize any other work of literature, a great novel, for example.
War and Peace.
War and Peace, yeah. I put that on my blog, and someone gave me a haiku of War and Peace. So here's the haikuization. Love, renew thy force. Thy edge should blunter be than tomorrow sharpened.
When we were talking before, you mentioned how the practitioners of Ulipo despised the Surrealists.
Yeah, Raymond Cano, I think, was originally a member of the Surrealist group in Paris. He was active in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, 70s, and so on. And Surrealism was a controversial group because they were very Marxist, very Freudian. They had certain very rigid rules. And André Breton, who is the czar of realism, mm-hmm. would actually excommunicate people from the group.
If they weren't following the strict rules.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny, we live in a relativist age, and he was an absolutist. So Cano and several others went their own way, and they then held some grudges against realism. But they don't believe in surrealism is romanticist.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe in the truth of the unconscious. And Ulipo, the group to follow, naturally went against it generationally. So they look for method, planning, mm-hmm. form, mm-hmm. but it's whimsical form often.
As you mm-hmm. have just
yeah.
proven. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you go ahead and read a couple of more? I remember that you read one called Course Description at the Word Temple Poetry Series.
Yes, course description is in prose, and of course, anyone who's taught, usually at the college level, has written course descriptions repeatedly. So I made one. Here is course description. Shakespeare, non-dramatic verse, English 619. In this senior seminar emphasizing Shakespeare's lyric production, we'll focus exclusively and intensively on Sonnet 56, which perfectly displays the great poet's vulnerability and craft. Using a variety of critical approaches from the Marxist and feminist to deconstruction, gender studies, and queer theory, we will examine the poem's palimpsestic structures of meaning. Was Shakespeare intimate with the reckless Lord Southampton who funded construction of the Globe Theater? When love's summer comes to winter, what season of love renews it? Course requirements include a 56-page seminar paper employing at least two of the above critical schemes. Formalist readings are not allowed. All papers and class discussions must relate to the historic collapse of dominant systems of sense-making in the post-Soviet period. Prerequisites, English Comp 1 and 2, or concurrent enrollment in those classes.
What a course.
Yeah, wow. Well, you realize how, you know, kind of puffed up a lot of course descriptions are.
Yes, yes, yeah. Absolutely. They are sales pitches.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there are some versions of Sonnet 56 that you can't read on the radio. For instance, Sonnet 56 has a crossword puzzle. It looks exactly like a crossword puzzle, and you have words inserted into it. And you you have the binocular version of the poem where you have two pages side by side, and it's like you're looking at the poem through binoculars.
Right, yeah, exactly, through two round patches of parallel patches of language.
It's fun stuff.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to a traditional form for just a minute. Would you read the villanelle?
I won't belabor the point by explaining what a villanelle is completely, but there are repeating lines. Lines 1 and 3 of the first stanza become guides for the rest of the poem. And there are always 19 lines. Villanelle. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. Today by eating we have dulled it a bit. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. Hunger makes your kiss sharper than your bite. I've known the best and worst of it. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. The hearts of lovers are always in the right. Though pleasure is touched with emptiness, our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. For a day of love, we starve a thousand nights. Only true lovers get their fill of it. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. No dullness now, only things that shine. Rivers drown in oceans, lovers in each other. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. The saddest lover knows the saddest lover knows the taste of life. Weight of darkness, sighs of night. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. Wow.
That's a successful villanelle.
That's a good poem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to declare that myself. But it has, I don't know exactly what we want from poetry, but somehow the themes of Sonnet 56 fit well. And I realize that there's a homophone in the third from the last line, weight of darkness, size, S-I-Z-E, of
right,
night.
Right.
Which sounds,
sounds like size, S-I-G-H. Yeah. It's nice. Well, what else would you like to read?
Well, you mentioned the flarf. I'd also like to do a ballad form. The lyric forms, I was surprised that the song forms came to me, like blues, ballad, readily. In the ballad, which I'll do now, and then I'll do flarf to show really the some difference and explain what flarf is. A ballad, of course, has four-line stanzas. Lines 2 and 4 rhyme generally. And that's why you can sing Emily Dickinson songs to the tune of The Yellow Rose of Texas, because it's in ballad or hymnal meter. Sweet love, where did you go today? Did you go to the wood alone or dance in town with another man? I think I'm turning to stone. I have been to the wood alone, said she. My heart is sharp for you. I have no appetite, no edge for another. I am only and always true. A little love keeps us hungry, said he. We eat till our eyes are closed. We are blind in our dreams, and in love, we eat love down to the bone. You're mine for a day and forever, said she. We never kill love with dullness. Our love has no fences, no ocean between us. Love is our promise, our fullness. I will go to the wood to find you, said he. There will be no pause in us, but a deep, shining, unending river, a lasting trust, a promise. Love, come as you are to the window. Our winter, so full of care, withdraws to the heart's last edge. Let's see how summer fares. So a ballad often has a dialogue aspect to it also. Oh, where are you going, Lord Randall? Where have you been, Lord Randall, my son? Oh, where have you been, my handsome young man? Oh, I've been to the greenwood, mother. They make my bed soon, for I'm weary with hunting and fain would lie down. Right?
Great, yeah. Great. I know you're going to read other forms, but because you just did that, you have a limerick in there. And because I have just a little bit of the Irish in me, I'm going to ask you to read that limerick.
Oh, that's a little naughty. Here
well,
it is.
It has to be.
But of course, limericks have to be. Limerick. There once was a young woman named Summer who fell fast in love with her plumber. She first checked his pipes, said, "I think you're my type," and thus was invented the Hummer. In time, their love took a plunge. She gave him only her tongue. His hungry eyes winked. In dullness, they sank. It was suddenly love with a fungus. One day, she gave him a feeding. A small serving leads to kneading. They loved once more all over the floor. Summer's welcome leads to feeling. So that rhetoric I was talking about of love lost, love regained. And Flarf. Flarf is easily explained this way. You put a search phrase into Google search engine, and it gives you thousands, even millions of options on that phrase that from the universal World Wide Web, right? Uh-huh. And then you sculpt that, or farm it, as they say, into a poem. And they're often necessarily kind of reckless and bad and pop in their tone. Because of what, you know, all the stuff you find on the web. So here's my attempt at flarfing. Love, force it, and it disappears. Courtney, love is a force of nature. Lair of the crab, ineffable wisdom. I love you guys. I love your hair. Love force is perfection force. And here I lay all alone, toss and turnin', a phoenix rising from the dirty south. Force vomit says make love, not war. Meatwork, frylock, and master shake. Fur-footed, love-force, two-minute miracle. Jim Love and the blue groove tube. Gravitation and love won't be denied. The purity of our false love is clear. One look at you and I can't disguise I've got hungry eyes. Blow monkeys. Scientific name, Bubo virginiensis. Particular screams, I just did a fatty. Two witches, lyrics for my use only. Her love had died, calling and teaching. Hungry fish, hungry cat. She held up half the sky. Who sent you, the man asked, when the baby opens its eyes? I'm coming out like a 45, spinning like a Wurlitzer. Bright and dark denotes eyes. The judges have sharpened their knives. Chain-smoking, wielding a sharpened spoon. Love needs a nursing home. Love needs more girl songs. Love needs to die, sporting geeking eyes. Love needs a heart, a sea of stars, into the myopic. A canvas-covered cabin in a crowded labor camp.
All of that from
yes.
Sweet Love, Renew Thy Force.
Yes.
It's insane.
Yeah, no, it's and you know, it's very tasty, the options, if you're willing to just relax and say, okay, this is not going to be a traditional work. Right?
You better say that.
Right. It's if it becomes lyrical, it becomes lyrical by another route completely.
Right.
Yeah.
Not intention.
Right.
Yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead and read a couple of more?
Okay. Let's see what I picked out.
One you read at the Word Temple Poetry Series that people really got a kick out of was the personal ad.
Oh, yeah, personal ad. Okay. Let me do a little pretty one before I do personal ad. I had personal ad marked. That's good. This is Imagist. And I think this was, there's sound, sound can be an image as well. And I was impressed with Dr. Zhivago when I saw it when I was a college student, right? Mm-hmm. There's a scene right at the end of this poem that comes from Dr. Zhivago. It's a sound image. But here we go. The riverbanks are white, town and bell covered. The last water moving slows to a freezing. Love is fast asleep. Summer far away. Tip of a branch taps on the window. Mm. So it's like that, you know, they talk about poems reaching towards silence. Imagist poetry, I think it is ready for silence a little bit. It needs space around it. And the isolated event, the isolated realization. And so love is fast. This approaches Shakespeare only in the third stanza. Love is fast asleep, summer far away. Yeah. And personal ad. Okay. scholarly SWM, that single white male. Is that right? Yeah, I guess that's what it means, isn't it?
Yeah.
Scholarly SWM 59 with discreet tattoo and private means seeks companionship with younger woman 30 to 40, leading to long-term relationship. Enjoy reading, speed walking, romantic strolls, ballroom dancing, dog races, gourmet cooking, and motorcycle racing. Divorcees only. Love life needs gentle feeding. Bad experience with heavy metal fans, mosh pit girls, dog breeders, and x-ray technicians. No desperation and no dullness. The glass is half full. Prefer carefree, minor melancholia okay. We'll travel oceans for the right person. Let's welcome summer together. We'll check box daily. Contact Ned at the Love Nugget, box Q134, or leave discreet message at 555-GOT-MILK.
How did you do that one?
Yeah.
How did you get that out of Sonnet 56?
I don't know.
What was your method?
It was the same as when I wrote a novel many years ago called Saigon, Illinois. I made a list of scenes autobiographically from my own experiences during the Vietnam War, working in a Chicago hospital as a conscientious objector. So I wrote down a series of scenes. In this case, I wrote down a series of formal possibilities on a list. And so I had a playlist, and I had written down a personal ad. So I just fit the material to the personal ad. No desperation and no dullness, et cetera. There are hints of the Shakespeare in it.
Right. How about one more from
one
the
more?
Book? Yeah.
I think a really, really short one, and it's kind of a good way to finish things probably. It's epigram. There's also epitaph. I think that's the last.
That's the last poem in the book.
Yeah. I think I'll do epitaph. Epitaph is, of course, what goes on a tombstone. It's has to be a very concise poem. You imagine it being cut into stone and having to stay there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to edit this one, right?
Unless it's Sylvia Plath's tombstone. That got edited.
Really?
Yeah, it's been vandalized a lot because of Ted Hughes' name appearing on it.
Oh, so people angry with Ted for his role in her demise. So epitaph. Here lies love, whose love was deep, fallen from the cliffs of sleep. Let winter and summer enfold her. The gods of love now hold her.
That is just beautiful. I do want to talk for another minute away from the book, because you and I tried to record this show when you were in Mexico recently, and it didn't work. So we didn't get to air the show when we wanted to. But before you were in Mexico, like just a few days before you were in Mexico, you were in Vietnam. Can you talk just for a minute about what it was like? What were you there for, and what happened?
A trip was planned for us to visit four or five places in Vietnam, starting with Hanoi and ending with Ho Chi Minh City, including Da Nang, Quang Nai Province, and Ha Tinh Province, where my co-translator of Nguyen Trai, selected poems of Nguyen Trai, lived. I visited his family. Beautiful trip. But quite exhausting, too. It included a 14-hour sleeper car ride in a train, snaking down through the flatlands and mountains of Vietnam. But 14 hours is too long to be on a train.
Yeah.
But at any rate, it was a wonderful trip. And Nguyen Trai is a hero poet of Vietnam. He lived 1380 to 1442 and was instrumental in helping establish politically the first dynasty of Vietnam after kicking out the Ming dynasty of China. So they love Nguyen Trai. And we were greeted royally. We were on all the national newspapers, even the Communist Party main page, which I thought is quite an achievement.
Well, when you came to the Word Temple Poetry Series with the translation of his poems.
Yes.
With Wen Do. And I'd love for both of you to come back up here sometime and do a show on that book.
We'd love to do it.
Good. Okay.
That would be
wonderful.
We'll
make that happen. Well, thank you so much for coming up again, Paul.
It's a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And that concludes the conversation with Paul Hoover. He read from Sonnet 56. Up next, Melissa Stein, author of Rough Honey, will be joining us. But first, this little musical interlude. This is Big Mama Thornton.
Yeah!
Was Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog, and that version was charted before Elvis Presley's version was. We are back to Word Temple, and this is Catherine Hastings, and it's KRCB 91.1 FM. Up next is Melissa Stein. She is the author of Rough Honey, winner of the APR, American Poetry Review, Honickman First Book Prize, selected and with an introduction by Mark Doty. The book was also a finalist for the Northern California Book Award in 2011, along with two other poets, Matthew Sapruder and Camille Dungy. Published by American Poetry Review with Copper Canyon Press, the poems in Rough Honey have been praised by Molly Peacock as a miracle of a first collection. Major Jackson calls her language seductively alert and textured enough to evoke rarely contemplated worlds. Let's go now to Melissa Stein. Welcome, Melissa, and congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. I want to ask you a few things, then I'll let you loose with a book a little later on in the show. But before we begin, why don't you read the opening poem?
Happy to. The first poem is called Olive Spread, Honey, and Salt. The lanes are littered with the bodies of bees. A torrent took them, swarming in branches just as the white buds loosen their hearts of pale yellow powder. Each body is a lover, the one with skin blank as pages, the one so moved by the pulse ticking in your throat, the one who took your lips in his teeth and wouldn't let go, the one who turned from you and lay there like a carcass. If we were made to be whole, we wouldn't be so lost to each offering of tenderness and a story. Therefore, our greatest longing is our home. There is always the one bee that circles and circles, twitching its sodden wings.
Thank you so much. The book doesn't include much of a bio for you. There's a really tiny one on the back of the book. So would you like to tell us a little something about your background, where you're from for starts?
Originally from Philadelphia. I grew up in the suburbs of Philly and lived there most of my life until just after college, a few years after I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and then went to grad school at University of California at Davis. So that brought me out to the West Coast.
I wondered how you got out here.
Yeah, and I just couldn't leave because it was, I fell in love with the landscape in San Francisco and moved to San Francisco, and that was kind of that. So
kind of hard to leave once you get here, I would think.
Yeah, it's true.
When did you start writing poetry?
Probably early teens. Maybe I was 12 or 13. And again, it was kind of, I don't know, an escape or a way of kind of having my own little world, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was, the early poems were awful, just basically what you'd expect from a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old. But, you know, I just kind of kept at it. And eventually, I think if you do something long enough and read a lot, then you start absorbing other writers and hopefully develop something that's a bit more distinctive.
Well, your poems are quite varied. And so I am curious about who your influences are.
Well, earliest influences were E. Cummings and Edna St. Vincent Millay. Those were the two big ones that I always like to state because they were so formative back in high school. And I love Hopkins. So the word music in Hopkins is really stunning. And some of the writers that I got into in grad school stuck with me. Jane Hirschfield and Brenda Hillman. Mark Doty, of course. Jerry Stern. I've been reading him for years, and I'm stunned by his writing as well. So,
and we had a little chuckle there at Mark Doty because he is the one who selected your book Rough Honey for this prize, and he wrote an introduction for the book. So, thanks to Mark Doty. Huh?
Yes, which is amazing and unbelievable when it happened. Yes.
Well, of course, I have to ask you, are you a butcher's daughter?
I am not a butcher's daughter.
Why don't you go ahead and read Song of the Butcher's Daughter?
Okay. Song of the Butcher's Daughter. Can you imagine me at middle age still doing that? Can you even imagine me at middle age? White apron stained in cow's blood, pig's blood, chicken's blood. Oily gleam of the fat heap studded with flies. The smell always sickened me. It doesn't come off, you know. Steep in warm water and ivory, scrape under your nails with pins, you'll always reek of innards. Once I hit 13, in the raw blood each month, I felt like meat. They looked at me like meat, leering over the glass while I sawed through bone. I kept the knives sharp, better than sharp, wet stone, grindstone, dreamed and dreamed. The morning of my 16th birthday, I hopped the Greyhound to New York City with all I could find in the till. I made my way, met a rich guy. He says he'll put me through veterinary school. His arms around my shoulders as we stalk the city and window shop. There are the scarves that float like rain about to fall. Enormous sofas that'll survive apocalypse. In one showcase are knives, well-oiled and gleamy beside their leather sheaths. Clean and clean and clean and clean and clean.
I want to ask you about the book's title in just a minute, but the dedication to the book is equally interesting, I think. For the we of me. Is this a dedication to yourselves? how did you arrive at that?
That's interesting. It's actually a little snippet of a quote from Carson McCullough's book, A Member of the Wedding.
Uh-huh.
And
But you chose it.
But I did choose it. Yes, I did choose it. And the context in The Member of the Wedding is it's this young girl and she feels like everybody belongs except her and everybody has someone to belong to except her. And so she's looking for the we of me. She's searching for something in her life that makes her feel included or complete in mm-hmm. some way. And so, I mean, this book was a long time coming. And so that's kind of my homage to that fact. And also it was kind of a way of including everyone in my life who has made me feel that way, rather than having to single out one person to dedicate a whole book to.
Cool. So. good. Well, the title, Rough Honey, is an oxymoron. It's quite evocative. Does it imply the both sweet and fierce character of desire, something that appears over and over again in your book, although certainly not in every poem?
Yeah, I think that was the idea. I had, choosing a title is really difficult, and I actually did change the title at Mark's suggestion not long after the book was accepted for the prize. The title that I had was a bit too, academic and maybe a little cold. So while rifling through every possible word combination I could think of, I was thinking perhaps of calling it Rough, but which is a great title for a book, except it didn't seem to fully represent the other side of what's in the book, which I think is, I don't think sweetness of language mitigates a lot of the rough stuff or maybe ugly things or bad things that happen in the book, scary things. But to me, it's a balance. So that was kind of the genesis of the title.
Well, Doty notes in his introduction that there are many books of contemporary poetry out there that are organized as types of projects. A theme is chosen, perhaps to push the poet forward in finding more poems to write about, you know, that theme. He used an example, a whole book of poems centered on the history of tattooing. He notes that yours is decidedly not this type of book, that you focus instead on the needs of each poem. And how did you decide on the inclusions of the poems in this book? You know, how did it all come together?
Again, there are many, many permutations of this manuscript over the years. So it came together in myriad ways before it found this form. And it was actually two full-length manuscripts at one point that then began, you know, I pulled from there and made this manuscript. Mostly I think I just chose poems that I felt were the strongest poems and then figured out how they flowed together and how they fit together in sections, rather than starting with an idea of a book and then slotting the poems into the idea. So I do tend to write fairly organically and intuitively, and I think the way the book is set up and the way it flows kind of reflects that.
Well, I think it's really a strong, strong point of this book, that there are so many different kinds of poems in it. There are poems where you just play with language, period, fa la la, you know, and it's fun to read. It's a type of playground of language. An extreme example of this is Wind Sonnet, in which the whole poem is composed of words for the wind in different languages. And maybe you'll read that later. Also, Allergy is a good example. Would you read that now?
Happy to. Yeah, Allergy was very, very fun to write. Maybe one of the most fun in the book. And what it is it starts out with the common names of weeds and wildflowers and kind of takes off in a strange direction from from the actual names. Allergy. The ragweed, the goldenrod, the lady's slipper, the Queen Anne's lace, the figwort, bald lousewort, scaly finnegan, popcorn mouse pea, scarlet monkey flower, duck potato, demon blossom, horse brute, dog mange, lemon pepper, careful sward, peach juice drip, orange tipped runny nose, long bottomed boat flower, lover's lips, Elvis's hips, vampire mouse pod, Boston joy, leaping jester's hose, unhinge me not, missed a step, careful now, pearly nevermore, wild mead, socks breath, harlequin grass, wheelbarrow heart, hangman's noose, sparrow throat, talk too much, gypsy's fringe, cabbage squat, cloud cheek, rampant bitterweed, pup's mint, glass of milk, jar o' paint, can of beans, old man's bunion, buttered rumpkin, buxom lady painter, coiled snake wart, spinster's pod, pinch-faced hollow seed, boiling oil gloss, shivering Rembrandt's nose, leaping cellophane, something's crawling on you. Half-mast tasselberry, dead man's claim, the black-eyed don't press charges, the soupy-eyed Mary, the coy-faced petticoat drop, the empty lantern flower, bat-winged underbelly, foreglossed harrow tongue.
Thanks so much. Are some of these really not, you know, plants like the black eyed don't press charges?
reality sort of leaves the poem after a few lines.
Yeah,
so.
They're great names.
Although it's funny because I think a lot of people that hear it really think those are
every single one of them,
or most of them. Which means I think I did my job. Which is very
well. There are plants with such funny
weird
names.
Yeah. I kind of envy the people who wrote, you know, who named all those things over the years, like duck potato. I mean, who would ever? Yeah. They love language.
Well, Rough Honey includes forms. It has sonnets. It even has a pantoum in there as example. But you also have narrative verse, rather stately sentence structures, and sentences smashed together with no air in between words where you might expect air. Doty says that the openness of both form and the receptive longing body is the central subject of Rough Honey. Do you agree with that?
I think his introduction is really spot on. In fact, when I read it for the first time, it really illuminated some things about my writing that maybe I had, you know, gleaned but not really thought explicitly. So I was actually very grateful to him for his insights about my work. But yes, I would say it is about openness and how openness can lead to trouble of various sorts, how it's risky to be open in different ways. And sometimes when you do take those risks, there are consequences to the risks.
Yeah. So. Well, I think your poem Whitewater, which is the second poem of the book, is a really, really good example of this. Why don't you go ahead and read Whitewater?
Okay. Whitewater. Kayak flipped us, and the current dragged us through its rocks, arms sealed at our sides. It was a blast, meeting it all cranium first, like academics. Froth, foam, grit, and the taste. What was it? Asphyxiation. Psychedelic Escher in black-white cubes. Tableau enormous. Picnic tablecloth, but undulating, spiked into color. Crimson, canary. Until that last blow, ledge flat against my mouth hole. My whole body condensed to one blinding exclamation point, white protrusion of bone. White petals and light, pearl solid, luminous, all 4th of July and scattered. Pipe bombs, bottle rockets, Christmas crackers, oh, what a party, annihilation. Till the blue, blue, blue palm sweeping my forehead, the hair from my forehead and the ache of return, to the tenderness of paint sable brushed against silk. Powdered throat of the foxglove, flushed curve spiraling into a conch, velvet crowning the doe's nose, arms embracing the cello's hips, shoulders, and what shudders from them, coaxed or forced, distracted out of, with that blood-white flap blinking at me from your cheek, and something in the eyes, maybe trout or bass or salmon thrashing upstream, yellow glimmer and sickened. We're not going to make it. We'll make it. We're stranded, washed up on this hurricane shore, held together by blood, sticks, and mud. Oh, paper, oh, desks, oh, treatises. We weren't immune on those banks, sky flat as anything, a willow-like spider tree bending over us. I focused on its branches, on the branches of the branches. How comical, that word, twig. Surrounded by thousands of jokes, as blood darkened the silt, like a cave painting.
Thank you. Why don't you just go ahead and read a few poems of your own choosing?
Okay, great. All right, I'm going to read a poem called Want Me, and I gave myself the assignment of writing a seduction poem without any people in it. So there's no I, and there's no you, and no bodies in the poem, but hopefully it does what it's supposed to. It's called Want Me. Lemons crystallized in sugar, glistening on a blue glazed plate. The rarest volume bound in blood leather. A silk carpet woven so finely you can't push a needle through, that from one edge is the silver of a leaf underwater, and from the other, blue lumiere, first frost on the cornflowers. A duet for cello and wood smoke, violin and icicle, tangle of black hair steeped in sandalwood, jasmine, bergamot, and vetiver, and jeweled with pomegranate seeds. Panther's broad tongue, soothing hunt bruised paws, eyelids of ribbon snakes, taut skin of a lavender creme brulee, split vanilla pods swollen with bourbon, a luna moth's wings, enormous celadon trembling. And I think I'll read Robber Girl because it's got a pomegranate seed in it as well. There are definitely a few repeating motifs in the book, and somehow pomegranate seeds have made it in twice. Robber Girl. I took what I needed and nothing more. Not that last gold bracelet, fine as a braid, twined from three strands of a child's hair. Not that ruby tear, clear and faceted as a pomegranate seed. Just a blouse with gold threads, just a coat with red glass buttons. They always said I was too smart for my own good, and good only for making trouble. And I thought, trouble? What a beautiful word, half of troubadour. Wineskins, ballads, riotous by the canals, with much lifting of skirts and telling of tales. Syllables strung like pearls, on a backbone of half-light and gain. I'll read Pantoum. And a Pantoum, I'm sure a lot of your listeners, or most of them might know what a Pantoum is, but for the couple that don't, it's a traditional form of four-line stanzas. And the first and third line of the second and fourth line of the first stanza become the first and third line of the next stanza. And that goes on for as long as you want it to. So there's tons and tons of repetition in the poem. And I did do it on purpose. Didn't run out of words. And the other thing is that pantoums are so often called pantoum, which is great because it saves you the trouble of having to invent an innovative title. Pantoum. Little girl, your veins are showing through your skin again. And again, I will ignore it. I will lay you down in the ordinary clover and resume sex, our bored conspiracy. Your skin again and again, I will ignore it, although I can barely stand its blue-pink flush, and resume. Sex, our bored conspiracy, tethers me to the slim bent weed of your body, although I can barely stand. Its blue-pink flush of fish's gills, albino snake's pellucid scales, tether me. To the slim bent weed of your body, an artist might attribute the vulnerable beauty of fish's gills, albino snake's pellucid scales. I am your husband. I can't see things the way an artist might. Attributing a vulnerable beauty is like a wry poem admiring its own cleverness. I am your husband. I can't see things the way I did before I knew you. Now my life is like a wry poem, admiring its own cleverness. It alienates the one who reads. I can't remember what I did before I knew you now. My life, a deconstructed text. What's the point of writing that alienates the one who reads? I can't remember. What can save us from seeing too much? A deconstructed text? What? Is the point of writing that our roles are judged irrelevant? Only love can save us from seeing. Too much rain has filled the mossy gutters. Too many hours our roles are judged irrelevant. Only love returns me to this house at night where rain has filled the mossy gutters. Too many hours spent feeling thunder rattle the iron bed frame return me to this house at night where I'm like one treading water, mindless, spent. Feeling thunder rattle the iron bed frame, I mistake its tremble for my own. I'm like one treading water, mindless of the riptide, deadly current so strong, I mistake its tremble. For my own long sweet strokes in the pale water of the riptide, deadly current so strong, pull me out to sea and hold me long, sweet. Stroke in the pale water, your mermaid's flesh, you belong here tangled in sea reeds. Pull me out to sea and hold me, little girl. Your veins are showing through your mermaid's flesh. You belong here. Tangled in sea reeds, I will lay you down in this extraordinary clover. So this poem is a sonnet called Library. I dream a sonnet made of buttons, star-shaped, faceted jet, fabric bristled pink. One boasts a lurid trompe l'oeil cardinal posed stiff against its milky plastic sky. Paired off, the colors rise and fall like breath. A verse no doubt penned by the selfsame clerk who, disgruntled, refused promotion, perk, or punch cardless lunch hours, now arrogates, upends, and reconstructs the library by spine color. The emeralds here, rubies just there, and the voluminous onyx of all that flaccid pulp. Then dazed with pride, with anarchy's frank gorgeousness, sinks down among the transform stacks and weeps. And I wanted to mention that that poem mentions a library arranged by spine color, which Adobe Books in San Francisco in the Mission actually had an art installation where all the books were arranged by spine color. So you walked in there and you're just astonished by this rainbow and couldn't find anything. But nobody cared about that because it was gorgeous. So I will read a poem called Anaphylaxis, which this may be a debut because I'm not sure I've read this at a reading before. So we'll see how this goes. Anaphylaxis. The wasp there again when I surfaced, those dangling legs, the bud-like head, lethal black thorax drilling inches from my lake-clogged ear. I dove beneath and swam again to the limits of my breath, through the bath-warm surface, through cold current. Out of our element, what other story is there? Pursued, pursuer, panic in the long strokes. The death that insect carried was not the one I wanted. And oh, I wanted death, or thought I did. Days spent twitching a razor at my wrists, cuddling a little mortuary of pills in my palm. Yet when it came, I swam from it as any prey. There was still something left to want. And the last poem I'll read will be the title poem, Rough Honey. Bee stung, kerosene sister, kneeling saint, in the smackdown, the allegory, the happy ending. She wore lipstick, she wore red heels, she wore tunes from the jukebox. Behind the gas station, in the gravel, between boats moored to their pickups, with her palms out, collecting rain. It wasn't rain, her knees were bruised, sweet reek of gasoline, of dust and clover. Gold ring, milk carton, cigarette, black root and cinder. What did you ask for, O honeyfied tangerine sister? I used to watch you with the lipstick, the gestures in the mirror, the way your legs crossed, the skirt creased, the sun and thunder. Where did you go? I remember you walked like a soldier.
And that was Melissa Stein reading from her collection, Rough Honey. What are you up to now? Are you working on another manuscript?
Hopefully. Yeah, I finally carved out some writing time this summer, so I'm very excited about diving in again.
Good. Well, thank you so much for coming all the way up to Sonoma County.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And there's more coming up on Word Temple. Here is W.S. Merwin reading The River of Bees.
The River of Bees. In a dream, I returned to the River of Bees. 5 orange trees by the bridge and beside 2 mills my house, into whose courtyard a blind man followed the goats and stood singing of what was older. Soon it will be 15 years. He was old. He will have fallen into his eyes. I took my eyes a long way to the calendars, room after room, asking, how shall I live? One of the ends is made of streets. One-man processions carry through it empty bottles, their image of hope. It was offered to me by name. Once, once, and once, in the same city I was born, asking, what shall I say? He will have fallen into his mouth. Men think they are better than grass. I return to his voice, rising like a fork full of hay. He was old. He is not real. Nothing is real, nor the noise of death drawing water. We are the echo of the future. On the door it says what to do to survive, but we were not born to survive, only to live. ¶¶
Beat it, fleas, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it. Lithuanians, and let's do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Not to mention the Finns, folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins, some Argentines without means do it. People saying in Boston, even beans. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall. Their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks him, I know. Why ask if Shad do it? Way to bring me Shad and Roe in shallow shows. English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it.
And with Ella Fitzgerald, it's a wrap. Thanks again to Paul Hoover and Melissa Stein. And one announcement for you. The Sonoma County Book Festival will take place this year on Saturday, September 24th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in downtown Santa Rosa. Who's going to come to read that day? Jane Hirschfield, Al Young, Francisco Alarcón, Belva Davis, Maxine Hong Kingston, Megan McDonald, and many, many others. For information, check out the website at www.socobookfest.org. That's socobookfest.org. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you.